The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
Welcome to October. This is The Takeaway for Monday, October 3rd, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Forget Brexit, folks. Over the weekend in Colombia, it was Farxit. A referendum to ratify a historic peace deal in Colombia was rejected. A slim 50.24% of Colombia's voters, in a major shocker, rejected 4 years of negotiations between Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos and FARC leader Timoleon Jimenez, leaving open the possibility that the more than half century of conflict between these two sides would continue. Former Colombian President Uribe, who led the opposition to the peace accord, was calling for national unity after the vote. We're going to start by sorting out that shocker in Bogota, and we will get to the tax revelations in Donald Trump's leaked tax returns a little later in the hour. And that's some tasty business. Don't even think about missing a moment of this Monday edition of The Takeaway. And as I said, we begin with Nadia Drost, who is a Bogota-based reporter on assignment for the PBS NewsHour. She says there was no warning whatsoever for this outcome from the Colombia weekend vote.
I think there is a sense of complete and utter shock here throughout Colombia, both for Colombians who voted yes in support of the peace accords, but also for those who rejected them. The no side never expected to win. So the country has really been tossed into a state of confusion, looking for explanations and not really knowing what is going to happen next.
Is there any statistical indication of what happened? Did a lot of people stay home because they thought it was a foregone conclusion? And did the polls, which showed that yes was going to win, mean that a lot of people who didn't really want no to happen felt like they could vote their conscience?
We haven't seen detailed statistical analysis come in, but there is this big statistical upset where the expectations were so different from the results. As you said, polls leading up to the vote showed that the yes vote would sail in quite comfortably, and instead the no vote came in just a razor's edge ahead. One explanation is that, first of all, Colombia has a historical tendency to have very low voter turnout for any kind of election, and we saw that yet again. So only 37% of the electorate actually voted in what is probably the most important vote in Colombia's history. We had huge torrential rainstorms, particularly along the Atlantic coast, which polls had showed were more in favor of the yes side. That is a kind of stronghold of President Santos. And so, you know, there is speculation that perhaps if more people in rain-affected areas had been able to get out to vote, maybe it would have tipped it the other way, because the difference in the votes was so marginal. We're talking about a mere 50,000 votes.
Nadia, this has a quality of the Wizard of Oz to it. I mean, what happens now? It's as though the people of Colombia have told the FARC and the government, okay, bring us the broomstick of the Wicked Witch of the West, go back and fight.
Exactly. This was a minor miracle that this peace accord actually was signed. It was 4 years in the making. We're talking about ending a 52-year-old war. And the fact that so many Colombians voted against it and decided essentially not to give peace a chance has so many people dumbfounded. As to what is next, nobody knows. In fact, there seems to be no plan B on the part of either the government or the FARC. This possibility was simply not expected. We heard President Santos last night address the public and say that he was going to be calling for a meeting today, bringing together all political factions. That includes his rival, former President Alvaro Uribe, who has been the most ardent supporter and leader of the No campaign. And what's expected is that they will be talking about a possible renegotiation. Now, this opens a whole Pandora's box of complications. You can imagine if it was this difficult for the FARC and the government to reach an agreement on their own, and it took 4 years, if you bring in Álvaro Uribe, who has been both the arch enemy of President Santos as well as the FARC, I don't know how much longer it's going to take to renegotiate an agreement. What is surprising is that both the FARC and the government in the past have said that if this peace deal is not accepted, they would not go back to the negotiating table. There seems to be an openness on both parts to perhaps give that a try. The FARC also, in a statement last night, said that they are still committed to using words and not weapons in the search for peace in the future.
Well, let's hope that holds out. There were ripples throughout Latin America over the weekend as this vote and the shock settled in other places. I'm wondering what the implications are for the region. And is this political squabbling and a chess game, or do people in Colombia really have misgivings about any kind of a deal that doesn't punish the FARC more for the war?
I think this vote has really been a moment of reckoning for Colombians. And what it has essentially shown is that there are a lot of people who are not either willing to forgive the FARC or cannot simply face two major aspects of the peace accords. And one is that the FARC, under these peace accords, would not see traditional jail time. They would see alternative sentences. And the other is that they would have the chance to participate in politics. And those two things are very difficult for a lot of members of Colombian society to stomach. I think that on the side of the FARC, this vote sends a very strong message to them that the Colombian public is not ready to accept them back into society. And I think that, often in the mountains and jungles of Colombia right now, there are a lot of very nervous FARC fighters thinking, what does this mean for them? Do they have to go back to war? And if they don't, what kind of security guarantees are they going to have coming out of the bush eventually to a society which is not ready to accept them?
Nadia Dross is a Bogota-based reporter on assignment for the PBS NewsHour. Thanks so much, Nadia.
Thank you, John.
On Sunday, it was a referendum on migration in Hungary that drew out millions of voters who opposed the EU's efforts to relocate migrants within the country. But there were not enough of them to make the vote stick. Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban has suffered a defeat with his referendum, but he has still managed to show that millions of Hungarians are eager to express deep anti-migrant sentiment and boldly challenge the authority in Brussels and especially Germany's Angela Merkel. Eva Balog is founder of the Hungarian Spectrum and former professor of history at Yale. Balog left Hungary for the U.S. after the revolution in 1956. She called this a disturbing near miss for Prime Minister Orban.
Most people really think that this is not really about the so-called migrants, that is the refugees, because they don't really want to settle in Hungary. It is more a political ploy for domestic consumption. But I'm glad to report that he failed, because the referendum turned out to be invalid. Only 39% of the voting population actually voted, and that wasn't enough. They needed 50% plus one vote.
Was Viktor Orban attempting to play on the fears of governance from Brussels in the same way that the Brexit voters were trying to get the voters in the UK to distance themselves from the Eurozone, and this question of migrants is the issue he chose?
Exactly, except I just heard that he spent, first of all, more money on this campaign than Brexit did. And if you take into consideration the population, 60-some million people in Great Britain and the 9-some million in Hungary, per person, he spent about €5, while the Brexit cost 0.66 euro cent. So that gives you an idea what the campaign was like. Yesterday afternoon, I decided to listen to the state television station. It is supposed to be a public television station, but it's really a government mouthpiece. I have never heard anything like it. You can't understand that whole crazy situation in Hungary without listening to that broadcasting. Constant barraging that stories like they sent a reporter to Belgrade and who talked to some of the refugees who kept saying, oh, we are expecting a failed referendum and we are ready to go to Hungary and go through the fence. This kind of talk, it was really terrible.
Does the outcome here resonate across Eastern Europe as a pushback against these nationalist xenophobic tendencies?
Well, I'm hoping so. I very much hope so. Because this is a big failure for Viktor Orban. Yes, it's a huge failure. And of course, he tries to sell it as a great victory.
Tell us, if you could, what the people in your network are saying about the lead up to this vote and what's happened since.
My readers are on the liberal side. So they were all keeping fingers crossed for the referendum to fail. But of course, on the other side, there are people who are adamant. And you mustn't forget that this whole campaign has a very strong racial undertone. And so every time Viktor Orban is reminded that about 200,000 Hungarians escaped from Hungary in 1956, he always says that's not the same thing because, you see, we were welcomed here, but we are of the same culture. And some of the Fidesz supporters, the Fidesz is the party, the government party, claim that they are actually trying to save European white civilization. So it has a very strong racial undertone to the whole campaign.
Eva, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
Eva Balog is a founder of the Hungarian Spectrum and a former professor of history at Yale University. She spoke to us from New Haven, Connecticut.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Have you ever been told you're an idiot when you get a big tax refund from the IRS because you overpaid? Suddenly your good feelings are dashed because you gave the government a loan. Your refund is a sign of your stupidity. Well, the converse of this is the financial acumen being attributed to Donald Trump, whose 1995 tax returns, leaked to the New York Times, show Trump might not have paid federal income tax for 18 years since those returns were filed. We're not talking about a refund. It's no taxes paid at all on his income due to a $916 million loss for that year, most likely from his failed investments in his Atlantic City casinos, airline businesses, and purchase of the Plaza Hotel in Manhattan. A tax loophole called net operating loss allows Trump to carry over his business expenses, in this case almost $1 billion, onto his personal tax return. And while it's all legal, is it appropriate for a presidential candidate to game the system like the scurrilous Broadway characters in Mel Brooks' The Producers?
Don't you see Bloom? Darling Bloom, glorious Bloom, it's so simple!
With me to explain now is Helene Olin, money columnist and host of the Slate Academy podcast United States of Debt, and the author of the book, Pound Foolish. Helene Olin, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me on.
Now, I'm not a tax lawyer, but isn't this the premise of the Broadway show, The Producers? You take on a business that's going to lose money, and that's going to take care of your tax problems?
Right, but you're still losing money.
Right. So you're an idiot for losing money. You're a genius for not having to pay taxes. What do you make of these Trump remarks? Are they in any way intuitive?
I think this is something people have suspected for a while. We know that he has obviously not released his taxes on his own volition. And there's been a lot of suspicion that part of the reason why was because he wasn't paying any. Now we seem to have proof, in fact, that most likely he has not been paying taxes for a very long period of time, or at least federal taxes, I should say.
And It's one thing to say that not paying federal taxes represents a kind of moral, you know, turpitude in an era when we want infrastructure to be improved. But is it illegal?
The scandal is that this is probably not illegal. What we don't know is we don't know if it was challenged. I mean, these are just the first page. We don't know if these were subsequently amended. But the thing is about Trump's campaign is that this is almost in a way baked into it, right? Trump's whole appeal has been, I know how the system works, and I'm going to show you how the system works. So in a way, this really doesn't come as a surprise at all, I suspect, to anybody who supports him.
And the companies that leave the United States, they are also leaving for the same reason that Donald Trump is putting these business losses in the front of his return. They're basically playing, gaming the system. So he talks a lot about people leaving the country and that's bad, but it's the same game.
Right. I mean, there's a sort of almost like cheerful hypocrisy to this whole thing, right? You know, he wants to take away the hedge fund carried interest loophole, but he never talks about the loopholes he's taking advantage of. The same is true with the companies that are, you know, moving abroad to avoid the American tax bill. He doesn't somehow see himself as doing the same thing, which, again, to you and me seems ridiculous, but somehow to him makes sense.
If it turns out, based on the information from this one sheet of taxes, that he's paying no taxes, how is he doing it exactly? Just explain.
There's probably a couple of different things going on. He's first taking advantage of real estate loopholes. The way the laws work for real estate development, where you are a real estate professional, so not you and me owning a house, is that you can write your losses off against your personal income. So that's one of the things that's going on here. He's then doing something else that is available to the wealthy, net operating losses, where you can do basically the same thing through your limited liability companies and such. Again, not available to the vast majority of the population.
When you say loophole, that's because a regular CEO of, say, an auto company that loses money can't take the losses from that auto company against his or her salary and get a huge tax boost. But if you're in real estate and do the kind of business that Donald Trump does, you can basically boost your salary from tax losses of the business itself.
Right. Real estate gets favors from the government that simply no other business gets. They are that powerful. And that is just an enormous gain, an enormous benefit to them.
So Donald Trump gets paid to be a failure.
He more or less does. I mean, there's a joke in the real estate industry that when you run out the depreciation, you should just buy another property so that you don't have to pay taxes all over again.
Have you talked to people who will punish him for this? I mean, the Times gets all, you know, up in arms about this. It sounds as though we're a couple of public radio, you know, bleeding hearts. But is this the kind of thing that strikes at a certain ethos of American citizenship?
I think it does and it doesn't. Again, I think for most people, probably the majority of people, it just doesn't sound right. But I think for the core supporters, they see him as, you know, this savvy business guy working every last angle in the system. And to, you know, quote the former mayor of New York, Rudy Giuliani, he's a genius for doing this. And this is what a savvy businessman would do. And he's just going to use all these skills and know-how to somehow maneuver the United States into a better position.
What could send this over into another realm altogether if there are secrets that we learn that go beyond what we've already seen?
I think it really depends on what else comes out. It would be really curious to see what the IRS said about all of this, what the audits have been like. We know he's been audited. And how it's all shaking out, what he's doing and what he's doing now, by the way. That would also be a huge part. Keep in mind, this is from 20 years ago. What do his taxes look like from 3 years ago?
He could get a salary boost from a failed presidential campaign, right?
Who knows?
Helene Olin, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me on.
Helene Olin is a money columnist and host of the Slate Academy podcast, United States of Debt, and author of the book Pound Foolish.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
The pictures compete for your attention. YouTube testimonials from government soldiers speaking in front of Russian cameras. All soldiers in the Syrian army are brothers, he says. We serve together for 10 or 20 days or 4 years. It doesn't matter. We are all brothers, all equal here. No chosen ones. Pro-government fighters speaking to Russian television. And you can find the voices of opposition militia speaking to Western news organizations as well.
One thing about being in war zones is the unexpected always happens.
And then there are the anonymous voices, ISIS, with another message of death and fight on. The city of Aleppo smells the same whatever part you are in. Desert dust mixed with the smoke of burning garbage, fetid clouds of equal parts sewage and cigarette smoke are blown by breezes. There is no fresh air in Aleppo. But in Berlin, Germany, there is fresh air, where these people cry out freedom forever, despite you, Assad. They are demanding an end to the siege of East Aleppo in Syria at a demonstration over the weekend. Saif al-Din says he left his home in East Aleppo over a year ago. He lives in Dresden, Germany now as a refugee along with his children, both of whom were injured in a bomb attack. He came to Germany to seek medical treatment for them. He came to the demonstration so that the world doesn't forget Aleppo.
I came here to demonstrate for the people of Aleppo, who are the children of my city. It's a human issue. Children are dying, women are dying, who are guilty of nothing. It's not a political issue or anything. We are trying to communicate a message to the world, because in general, the Western media doesn't see what is happening. They don't ever see what's happening. Ever. Ever.
Saif says his city is wrapped in a fog of nothingness right now. Of the children covered in dust that make the front pages of Western newspapers or are stored in pictures on his own smartphone, we don't get upset anymore by this. It will happen again tomorrow, Saif says. The people still in East Aleppo include his parents and his sister.
Right now, the situation is that children who are 3 or 4 years old don't know a thing called a banana at all. They don't know what fruit is or what cookies are. They don't know anything.
The siege has intensified in the last 3 months. Last week was particularly brutal, with Russian and U.S. planes conducting attacks, while none of the remaining 250,000 Aleppo civilians are being allowed to leave. On September 19th, a humanitarian aid convoy headed to East Aleppo was bombed, an attack the United Nations has called a potential war crime. Now forces allied with the Syrian regime are amassing for what seems to be a final attempt to take over the eastern part of the city. Saif al-Din acknowledged that for now, there is no escape.
In the current situation, I ask for just medicine and food, enough for everyone. That's it, only that. The rockets, of course, we really hope the rockets will stop, and the bombings. We really hope the bombing stops, but right now, there is an emergency. There are hundreds of injured children and women. We hope that some country in the world will take up this issue and take these injured people and treat them.
Of the 4.8 million Syrians who have fled their country, over 225,000 have made it to Germany. Tens of thousands live in Berlin. The demonstration on Saturday ended at dusk in one of Berlin's squares with almost joyful singing. Away from burning garbage and gunpowder, there were still clouds of cigarette smoke above the protesters. As the music wound down, they called for Aleppo, Halab, in Arabic, over and over again. A foreshortened U.S. Supreme Court is back in session today, and while the Senate keeps nominee Merrick Garland awaiting a nomination hearing to replace the late Justice Antonin Scalia, the 8 sitting justices will nevertheless reconvene to hear a new docket of cases. Free speech, trademarks, questions of racial and ethnic bias, and the use of intellectual disability in criminal prosecutions are all being brought forth as issues this term. Amy Howe is a reporter at SCOTUS Blog. According to Amy, the court is functioning as best it can in light of the vacant seat.
They are back at work. They have nearly full docket of cases, not quite as many as they may have had at this time last year. Last year at this time, they added 13 new cases to their docket, but this year they only added 8. There was a very interesting case about the trademarks for a group called the Slants and whether or not the Patent and Trade Office can refuse to trademark names Mark says thinks are disparaging, and this is something that will have an effect on the Washington Redskins. But most of them are not otherwise the kind of high-profile case that's going to have us sitting at our computers at the end of June hitting refresh while we wait for the Supreme Court to issue decisions.
And the question of race and gender and abortion, these perennial issues before the court, are they expected to be a part of this term?
On October 14th, the Supreme Court will meet for a private conference. And one of the cases at that conference that they'll be asking the justices to hear will be a case called Gloucester County School Board versus GG. And this is the case of a transgender student in Virginia who identifies as a boy and wants to be able to use the boy's bathroom. The lower courts ruled in his favor. And the school board went to the Supreme Court over the summer and asked it to step in on an emergency basis and block the lower court's requirement that GG be allowed to use the boy's bathroom, at least until the Supreme Court could weigh in. And in a little bit of a surprise, you know, when you go to the Supreme Court on an emergency basis, you need 5 votes. You only need 4 votes to grant review. And in a little bit of a surprise, Justice Stephen Breyer, whom we think of as one of the court's more liberal justices, joined the court's 4 more conservative justices in granting the school board's application to block the lower court's decision temporarily. He said he was doing it as a courtesy. So now the case is back, and the school board is asking the Supreme Court to weigh in on the merits. So we could know something in mid-October about whether or not the Supreme Court's going to take that case on.
What are the constraints on the 8 justices, missing a 9th justice that would affect the current cases? For instance, the Samsung versus Apple case is a big case. We don't necessarily want to get into the details of it, but is that something that would be delayed by the 8 justices and waiting for a confirmation hearing?
Well, it's hard to know, in any particular case. One thing that we have noticed, and we don't know exactly what the explanation is, but the Supreme Court granted a couple of cases in January of this year before Justice Scalia passed away. One of them is perhaps one of the most interesting cases this year. It involves religious liberty. It's the case of a church that applied for a grant from the state of Missouri to resurface its playground. And the state said, no, we're not going to give you that grant because our state constitution prohibits giving aid to religious institutions. The church says that's a violation of its right to freely exercise its religion. That was that case. There's an interesting case involving property rights. There's another case involving class actions, which have been a hot topic at the Supreme Court lately. They were all granted review in mid-January and have not yet actually even been scheduled for oral arguments yet, which is a little bit unusual, a little bit of a departure from the way that the Supreme Court normally operates. And so there's no way to know for sure, but I think it's at least a possibility that the Supreme Court recognizes, the 8 justices recognize that those might be cases that they might have trouble getting 5 votes to resolve, and perhaps they're purposely waiting to see if they might get a 9th justice. But, many of the Supreme Court's cases, when they had 9 justices, were decided by a vote of 9-0, 8-1, 7-2. So sort of the bread and butter of the court's docket will go on. But it's the cases on which the court is most closely divided that many of us are most interested in. And so, the court is certainly will be able to issue plenty of decisions. But the question is whether they'll be able to issue decisions in some of these high-profile cases.
Finally, the question of the Clean Air Act and the powers of the EPA to regulate power plants is in the D.C. Circuit. Is that likely to come up and get before the Supreme Court before the end of the term?
It'll depend a lot on the timing. The D.C. Circuit did just hear oral arguments on it at the end of September. And so it's a question, really, of how long it takes the D.C. Circuit to issue its decision, the hard deadline for granting review in cases and then hearing oral arguments in the same term is sort of early to mid-January. So it's not clear whether or not that can be on a sufficiently fast track to make it to the Supreme Court this term. And then there's the separate question of, you know, even if it does make it this term, will the court have nine justices if it were to hear oral arguments at the end of April? I think, you know, by the end of April, there certainly would be a good chance that the court might have nine justices, but there's no way to know for sure.
Amy, thanks so much for being with us.
Always great to talk to you. Thanks for inviting me.
Amy Howe is a reporter for that National Treasure, the SCOTUS blog. In the 80s and 90s, as America's public schools faced an educational crisis, they were also facing something else. Chaos and violence in the classroom.
Last year alone, there were 35 violent deaths in schools.
One student shot and killed another in a hallway.
Kids killing or being killed has emerged as a potential national crisis.
To answer that crisis, a political fad was born. Extreme discipline, no questions asked, zero tolerance, the policy was called. Under it, students were immediately expelled for certain bad behaviors. Assault, fighting, carrying a weapon could all bring immediate expulsion from school. But eventually, this cure for school violence proved to be worse than the disease.
7-year-old Lamont Agnew was kicked out of the second grade for 45 days for bringing toenail clippers to class.
Our partners at Retro Report looked into the quick rise of zero tolerance and its eventual demise. Retro Report producer Scott Michaels reminds us that zero tolerance was a simple solution, ill-equipped to deal with a very complex problem.
I think you have to remember that crime rates generally were just much higher back in the 80s and early 90s, and there was a very significant spike in crime that was being committed by teenagers, violent crime, and particularly with guns. That was a short-lived spike, but it was something that was happening and I think contributed to this feeling that we were losing control as a society and something needed to be done to make schools safer.
And it was a combination of, the clinical notion of zero tolerance regarding drugs, it seems, with this disciplinary notion embodied in the character of New Jersey Principal Joe Clark. Let's recall.
Any drug pusher I see trying to enter into those 35 doors, I'm going to beat the hell out of him.
And did he really walk around with a bat?
Yeah, he walked around with a bullhorn and with a baseball bat.
Gosh, it's all coming back to me now. And the movie Lean on Me is based on him.
That's right, yeah.
And did that propel his notoriety and propel the application of zero tolerance policies?
I mean, I think Clark was somebody who was emblematic of sort of a broader cultural shift that was going on in the late 80s and early 90s. And this feeling that schools were too violent and that we were spending too much time worrying about the disruptive kids and not enough time worrying about the good kids who wanted to learn.
So what was an example of how this became viewed as an overreach?
As you go on in the years and we get to the late 90s, then you start seeing examples of kids who are getting suspended or expelled or arrested for really minor things like bringing a toenail clipper to school.
Tell me about Jeremy Hudson.
Jeremy Hudson was someone that we interviewed for our piece. And about 10 years ago, when he was 12 or 13 years old, he brought a multi-tool like a Leatherman to school with him.
So it's got the pliers and the knife and the nail file and the screwdrivers and all that sort of
thing. Yeah. I mean, what he said was that he was helping his mom poke a hole in her belt before he went to school. And he took it with him to school and it fell out of his pocket. And somebody saw it and said that it was a knife. And he ended up being arrested at school.
I think I would have had a lot more opportunities if that one incident was handled a little bit differently. I wouldn't have had a juvenile record. I think my life would have took a different path.
What he said and what a lot of the research has shown is that an incident like that can set you off on a different path. And what he felt happened was that it really turned him off from going to school.
Since you mentioned toenail clippers, let's listen to this case.
7-year-old Lamont Agnew was kicked out of the second grade for 45 days for bringing toenail clippers to class.
Now, how does something like that even happen?
Well, so going back to the 90s, the federal government required what they called zero tolerance, meaning automatic expulsion if you brought a gun to school. And What happened was that schools across the country started implementing that rule, but they started going farther. So they started requiring mandatory suspension or expulsion for any weapon or for drugs or for fighting or for all sorts of things. And so then you get examples like this where a toenail clipper is considered a weapon, and that means you have to be suspended.
And metal detectors, this is the era of metal detectors on schools?
Yeah, I mean, it's all part of kind of the same general trend of feeling like schools are too violent, they're out of control, and we need to do something to make sure that they're safe.
When did the pendulum begin to swing the other way?
I mean, you start hearing people really complaining about this really as early as the late 1990s, but I think it's taken this cultural shift that we've seen over the last 10, 15 years of people being a lot more aware of the unintended consequences of tough on crime.
We've got to be tough, and we have to take those young people who are, in essence, predators, even at a young age, and separate them from the rest of society.
Now, when he was Deputy Attorney General in 1998, Eric Holder, speaking there on CNN, was he a follower or a leader in this policy?
I mean, I think that he was a follower. You know, a lot of these policies were enacted before he came into office. You know, he was sort of the public face of the Justice Department at the time. He said that, you know, even towards the end of his days as Deputy Attorney General, he started to have some misgivings about what was happening.
And would you call this statement from your own interview regret? Listen.
Black kids are three times more likely to be suspended or expelled than their white counterparts. They are much more likely to be treated harshly for the same conduct. If you are suspended or expelled, you're much more likely to drop out. If you drop out, you are much more likely to become involved in the criminal justice systems. And this has a huge, huge impact on the lives of young people.
When did he change?
You know, that's a good question. He said that, you know, when he came back to government in 2009 as Attorney General, he started reading more of the data and the literature about school suspensions and about the impact of zero tolerance. And I think what you see was that the big concern when he was Deputy Attorney General was guns, was keeping guns out of school. But the attitude, the zero tolerance attitude, had a much, much broader impact than anyone had really intended at the time.
Finally, how much do you think this zero tolerance idea, fad, whatever you want to call it, contributed to the momentum, really, that resulted in the crisis that we're dealing with today, and that is the level of incarceration of African Americans in prisons and various policies that start with zero tolerance, I suppose, and end up being incarceration rates that we just can't deal with right now?
Academics and activists call this the school to prison pipeline, and it's this idea that the path to jail and prison starts at school, and suspension and arrests are much more likely to impact African-American students than white students.
And we're unraveling it slowly today, but it's proving very difficult.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of schools, even ones that had strict zero tolerance policies, are trying to go another way and trying not to suspend and arrest so many kids. I think it seems to be working quite well in some schools. Other schools, I think, are having a harder time finding another policy that works.
Scott Michaels is a producer for Retro Report. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And here's something to take with you today. Ever wonder how your cells shrink in response to threat or distress? We spend lots of time, of course, thinking about and studying how our cells and bodies grow. Yoshinori Osumo was today awarded the Nobel Prize in Medicine for his research on how, under certain circumstances, cells can package up parts of their protoplasm and simply recycle it. It's a process known as autophagy, derived from the Greek meaning self-eating. Osumi began a series of experiments in the 1990s, which he identified genes necessary for autophagy by studying baker's yeast. The complicated process governed by genetics suggests ways in which dysfunctional cells begin doing things harmful to an organism. The Nobel Assembly said, Yoshinori Osumi's discoveries opened the path to understanding the fundamental importance of autophagy in many physiological processes, such as in the adaptation to starvation or response to infection disruptions. Autophagy disruptions have been linked to Parkinson's disease, type 2 diabetes, and cancer. Nonsense, says the very happy Osumi, who has humbly referred to himself as, quote, just a basic researcher in yeast. Yeast. Hey, he could have been a maker of beer or wine. He still could be. That's all for today. Thanks for listening. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thank you.
PRI, Public Radio International.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.